From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Crime and punishment. Rogue investor Bernard Madoff is in jail awaiting sentencing after pleading guilty to running a Ponzi scheme that bilked investors out of billions of dollars. The Iraqi man who threw his shoes at former President George W. Bush gets a 3-year sentence for his act of protest. And questions remain whether Sudan's indicted president will ever see the inside of a jail. That's on today's Reporters Roundtable. With us are Kevin Merida, the assistant managing editor for National News for The Washington Post, and Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hi, Tony.
Hey, thank you, Tony.
Let's start with this. Disgraced investor Bernard Madoff pleading guilty to 11 counts of fraud, money laundering, perjury, and theft, wiping out $65 billion in savings from countless unsuspecting investors. Set to be sentenced now on June 16th, facing a maximum jail sentence of 150 years. Kevin, at his age, 70, a long sentence would be the same as a life sentence. Does that matter? Should that matter?
Well, I think it probably matters sometimes to judges, but often not. And you know, I think this has been such a huge public outcry. It kind of represents the greed ethos of Wall Street and the financial marketplace that really has gotten people upset in this country in the last decade and a half. I mean, you think back to Enron, and there was a great hue and cry for the people who were in charge of the company to get jail time. And I think that there will be a lot of pressure. I know the judges don't always necessarily look at public pressure, but I do think that there is a certain sentiment in the country that he should be punished, and I suspect him to get, some considerable jail time.
Well, Clarence, the question now is, who else may have been involved in this scheme? Is it reasonable to believe, do you think, that Madoff pulled this off all by himself?
No, it's not reasonable to believe that. I think, obviously the investigations are continuing. There may be other people brought in and charged. That's important. What's really important with this case is why did it happen? How can Ponzi schemes like this, and that's what this was, and Madoff himself said so in court. It was a Ponzi scheme, the kind of two-bit hustle that I covered as a young reporter in Chicago, and now we're discovering that a brilliant man, one of the most prestigious people on Wall Street, like Bernie Madoff, was engaging in a Ponzi scheme that he himself says got out of his own control, that he thought he'd just do it for a little while and he just couldn't stop. This is a strange kind of madness here. But I think the people, in that courtroom, the victims were relieved that the man was convicted. How long does he serve? I don't think, and who else gets brought in? That doesn't matter to them as much now as the possibility they might get some money back. Can they? Will they? How much of it? How much of his estate can they claim? That sort of thing seems to be what the big question is now.
Right. Speaking of jail sentences, guys, let's talk about how two different international cases were dealt with in very different courts of law. Last December, the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at then-President Bush during a press conference, which was a criminal act, by the way, that also made him a hero in the minds of the Iraqi journalist, has been sentenced to 3 years, even though his lawyers vowed they could appeal. He could have gotten as much as 15 years. But my question, Kevin, is this. Is this Iraqi justice or American justice being exerted in an Iraqi court?
Well, it's certainly going to play that way and is playing that way in Iraq. It becomes kind of a metaphor for the occupation of Iraq in the eyes of Iraqis, and that's a war that has not been popular anywhere, really. And so this kind of compounds the unpopularity of it. The Iraqi journalist was, there were people outside the courtroom weeping and people supporting him. I mean, 3 years would seem like a lot for throwing a shoe, but it became kind of a symbolic, as you put it, a symbolic editor to punish something for an act against an American president.
In the Horn of Africa, Clarence, another stab at international justice is taking place with so far unclear results, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is thumbing his nose at an arrest warrant for war crimes passed down from the International Criminal Court. Some observers are suggesting that the man accused of perpetrating atrocities in Darfur may never see the inside of a jail. Is that likely, do you think?
Well, what he's done is to put the ball back in the courts of the United States and other members of the world community. Will people go after him? Will other African countries go after him? Countries led by leaders who are concerned, some of them, if they too might be brought up on war crime trials later on, brought up on war crime charges. The United States has had a working relationship with Sudan. They've been cooperative with us in Bush's war on terror. Sudan was a former haven for Osama bin Laden, and it is also an oil power, not a big one, but enough that China is an important ally of theirs. This is an interesting case that is much bigger than Bashir himself, because the ability of the international community to bring war criminals, to hold them up to account, has tremendous implications for the future of Africa and the rest of the planet.
Let's switch topics again. This is a news story that keeps coming back and back and back and back, kind of like a weed in a sense. The GOP still trying to pick up the pieces from November's election, but at the moment, Republican National Committee head Michael Steele continues to raise the hackles of many in the party. A new interview published in GQ magazine said that Steele believes abortion is a choice, homosexuality is not. These are his words, not ours. The statements run counter, of course, to the views of many social conservative. Now, Steele keeps talking, and in your paper, Kevin Merida, the Washington Post, you've run stories even today about whether or not this will cost him. One of the columnists on your staff seems to suggest that this will not force him out.
Well, I think it's going to be something to continue to watch. I mean, this is kind of the worst kind of case for the Republican Party. I mean, they elected the first African-American chairman, and in part he was elected because they thought he would present a new face for the party, someone who they thought was good on television and could really articulate the direction, a new direction for the party. And he seems to have had a number of, as one Republican put it, foot and mouth problems. And you know, it's very different. Clarence will appreciate this. It's one thing to be on television and to talk about the issues of the day. It's another one to represent your party when you have a broad range of interest in the party, and particularly those on the right. And this is what got him in trouble. I mean, he's trying to simultaneously make the Republican Party a majority party again in the country, and to win major elections. And at the same time, you know, you've seen that there are many moderates moving away from the party. If you look at the elections, there are not many moderates left in the Congress. And you see a lot of rumblings out in the states about the party's direction and it being kind of captive to its southern wing. And so he has a lot of difficulty. Whether he remains as party chairman in the long run is a question that may even pivot on whether or not he can raise money, because at the end of the day, that's probably one of the biggest roles of a party chairman.
Well, Kevin raises an interesting point, Clarence, because there is another voice emerging in the Republican Party that could be considered moderate, and this person seems not to be backing down at all. I'm talking about Senator John McCain's daughter, Megan, who blogs some pretty bold statements that criticize the popularity of Ann Coulter, the conservative pundit. She wrote, quote, "I straight up don't understand this woman or her popularity. I find her offensive, radical, insulting, and confusing all at the same time. But no matter how much you or I disagree with her, the cult that follows Coulter cannot be denied." What about Megan McCain? Is she a rising voice for them?
Gee, Tony, I was hoping you'd let me have a crack at that Michael Steele story, too.
Okay.
But Meghan McCain is indeed a part of that same story. As Kevin said, the party is divided between its own very conservative base, especially the social conservatives there who provide those troops that get out there and knock on doors, and the moderates that it needs. Senator Mitch McConnell recently talked about how it's become a regional party and said, I didn't sign up for a regional party. I want a national party. And Michael Steele's strength is that he can reach out to moderates. And I think, you know, Meghan McCain is an example of the kind of young Republican that the party needs. They need young people like that. She's a former Democrat herself, Democratic voter, and her father are both moderates in many ways. You know, the conservative base turned against her dad in 2000. They turned against him this past year. It wasn't until Sarah Palin came in on the ticket that they got excited about the McCain-Palin ticket. She has gone up against Ann Coulter now, who is not an elected official, not accountable. She's the female Rush Limbaugh. She's a show person. Rush Limbaugh has about a 25% approval rating, according to a recent poll I saw, and that's not enough to win elections. It's great for radio ratings, though, right?
Well, that's you're right.
Same thing with Ann Coulter. She sells a lot of books, but they're really hurting the party that they supposedly stand with.
Well, it's interesting. I wish we had more time to talk about both of them, but the Republican Party is managing to stay in the headlines, even if it's not for things that they necessarily want. Clarence and Kevin, thank you both.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, joining us from the NPR headquarters in Washington, and Kevin Merida, the assistant managing editor for National News for the Washington Post, joining us from the studios there.
Ann Nesby's musical roots reach way back to her hometown in Joliet, Illinois. That's where she came up singing in her church.
For me, as an artist, my family's roots of being a Christian go way, way back. God was the center of our entire life. So we knew that we were going to go to church, and it was not a question. They didn't give us a choice or an option whether we were going to go to church, and we were going to be in the choir. If you had any inkling of a voice, if they needed you in the choir, you were going to be there.
In the early 90s, Nesby joined the gospel choir Sounds of Blackness. She became the group's lead vocalist, and she won her first Grammy for the album Evolution of Gospel. Ann Nesby left Sounds of Blackness to pursue a solo career. She's just released a CD called This Is Love. She talked about her new album and her new sound with NPR's Tony Cox.
You know, I was talking about you to someone the other day, and I said to them, man, can she sing, which you really can. And their response was, you should see her make a room move by the sheer power of her voice. How do you do that?
I'm sure that it has to be the anointing of God because there's no power of my own. I can maybe attribute it to the many, many hours of choir rehearsal in church, church all day, Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, and Sunday night, church hopping in between being the foundation. But other than that, I don't have a clue.
You know, Ann Nesby, you are called an inspirational R&B artist. And traditionally,
yes.
I know that you know this. These two music forms have often clashed, but they've also been successful for a lot of artists. Do you ever feel conflicted at all about singing R&B under the halo, so to speak?
Absolutely not. I have the firm belief that all music is God's until we defile it with lyric. When God gives me a story to tell, I'll tell it, whether it's labeled R&B or whether it's labeled gospel. If God gives me that music and that song in the context of a personal relationship or our spiritual relationship, we have to learn how to treat each other outside of church, because we do come home and have a relationship with our husbands, our significant others, our children, and we have to learn how to be right within our households first, because charity begins at home. So if there's a lesson to be taught, it can be taught very freely with music.
You know, let's follow up that point talking about with the new CD, This Is Love. This project feels like it straddles two musical worlds to me, R&B and spiritual. Is that what we can always expect when Ann Nesby is singing?
I think that you can expect whatever God gives me. And I'm definitely going to talk about issues that have concerned me or have concerned those I love, because I know that people overcome by the testimony of others and seeing that others can make it. And sometimes when you're going through something, you feel like you're all by yourself. But if you have that song that talks about that very issue, sometimes fans come up and they say, you know, I just felt like you were singing directly to me because I'm going through that exact thing. And when people come up and say that, I feel like the mission that I've taken on is being completed. In fact, the single that I have now, I Apologize, mm-hmm. is a song that we all can relate to. If you're in a relationship, there are times when you can't just come right out and stand in front of your mate and say, you know, I'm really sorry. I want to make it up to you, baby. Want you to know that I love you. This is just a relationship issue that I put to music.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that song, because that was one of the ones I was going to ask you about, because it's really one of those slow, you know, lights low kind of songs, begging for forgiveness, stayed out all night, didn't call, you know,
yes,
you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and yes, absolutely.
This is the kind of song that you normally hear the fellas, you know, who've gone out and done wrong and come home and are begging for their mates to forgive them. You don't usually hear women talking about being out all night long. I got to ask you, how much of this is you from real life?
Well, this one isn't me, but it is a situation that I know women come up against, because sometimes sisters do go out and they stay out all night with their girls. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes sisters, we have a little bit of a problem saying, I'm sorry sometimes when we're wrong.
You think?
And that's what the song says, pretending like I'm never wrong and blaming everything on you. Well, that's what the song is all about. And some, you know, we have to say I'm sorry too.
Now, let me ask you about one other song. Our time is running a little short. I want to get two more things in here. One song, in contrast to the song about I Apologize, is track number 6, Thank God. Of this song are almost Aretha-like. In fact, your mom played Aretha in your house, didn't she, when you
oh,
were
yes,
young?
Oh, yes, she did.
Did some of the Queen of Soul sink in?
Oh, absolutely. I was listening. My father was actually the first person that introduced me to Aretha, and that didn't happen to be a R&B track. It happened to be the first gospel song that I ever heard Aretha sing, and that was Precious Lord, as she was singing on a recording with her father. And my father said, listen to this, babe. After that, when my mother would sit down and listen to Aretha Franklin, I heard her doing a whole different thing. So some of those licks that you hear me do
mm-hmm.
is an incorporation of listening to Aretha, Gladys, Patti, Stevie, Donny Hathaway. So, I mean, I'm not afraid, I'm not ashamed to say that I owe a lot of the learning that I did from pioneer artists that were great and successful, and I enjoyed everything they did, and I incorporated some of that into the Ann Nesby style.
Gospel audiences are different than non-secular audiences, are they?
Sometimes gospel audiences I think, are somewhat jaded in that they have great gospel singers that are always in their church all along as they're growing up. You know, when I was growing up, I went to a church that on any given Sunday, any one of the soloists in the choir could slay you and knock you under the bench. So gospel audiences are already accustomed to great, great singers. So you really, really have to be a singer to really, you know, kind of set a church on fire. That's my opinion.
Well, Ann Nesby, from what I've heard, you can definitely set a church on fire. Thank you so much for coming in. The new album is This Is Love.
Every time I see your lovely smiling face.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with R&B and gospel singer Ann Nesby.
I feel the magic and the twinkle in your eyes.
That's our show for today, and thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, finding a good home for African orphans. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
A new book captures President Barack Obama's meteoric rise to political power, as well as the more intimate aspects of his family life. NPR's Allison Samuels recently spoke with Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor for Essence magazine and editor of the book The Obamas, Portrait of America's New First Family.
Economic times are bleak right now. There is catastrophic job loss, huge bailouts, and little relief in sight. And the guy responsible for bringing us out of this mess? President Barack Obama. He's definitely got his work cut out for him. But with all these troubles, it's easy to forget how Obama's amazing election and grand inauguration really affected the country. Patrick, with your new book, it captures President Obama during this time. What compelled you to put this book together?
Well, at Essence magazine, our readers have been following the Obama family, you know, almost since 2004 when they went to Washington when he was the senator-elect from Illinois. Michelle Obama had been featured in our May 2006 issue of Amazing African American Women, and we knew that she was a voice and someone who, you know, if she got the spotlight, that our readers would want to know more about her. So when he announced that he was running on February 10, 2007. Although the media, you know, basically handed the election to Senator Hillary Clinton and favored her to carry the African American vote, we were hearing from a lot of our readers that they wanted to know more about the Obamas. So we followed the family from February 10, 2007, when he announced in Springfield, Illinois, that he was running for office, up until that magical moment on November 4th in Grant Park, where the family, you know, became our first elected African-American, first family in our country. And we decided to put it all together in a book that we called The Obamas, Portrait of America's New First Family.
Now, because you were there so early, is that why you got such great access to them, because you were there from the very beginning?
Well, the magazine was there from the very beginning, mm-hmm. Allison. I'm still, like, you know, at arm's length from the Obamas,
right.
which I like as a journalist, right? But the magazine, yes, we worked diligently, with some amazing reporters and writers like Gwen Ifill and Charlene Hunter Gault and Isabel Wilkerson, who are all in the book with their incredible essays and portraits and profiles of the Obamas at various stages throughout the campaign. And we sort of tied it all together in a bow with images from the inauguration, as well as some of now President Obama's memorable speeches. And the goal for the book, Allison, really, we were listening to our readers, and so many of our readers are, you know, our family members, our spouses, our parents, our sisters, our brothers. And there had been this movement in the African-American community to collect anything Obama-esque. I mean, I went home to North Carolina, and so many of my relatives and friends and, the people I've known all my life had Obama magnets and flags and cups. And so it was almost like everyone was putting together a time capsule of this incredible journey, and we wanted to make sure that what we included in the time capsule would be something that would capture and reflect our reader and also capture and reflect what we try to do every month at Essence Magazine, which is to portray us at our best, play to the best of who we are.
And that makes sense. I was going to ask, like, how did you actually choose, because there was so much out there. How did you actually choose sort of the best of the best in terms of what you thought people wanted to see? Was it just a matter of going through everything you guys had done, Essence had done, and picking out what you felt you got the most response for?
Well, here's an inside scoop, Allison. We actually put together the first book in about 8 days just because of the production deadline to sort of make it happen. Remember, on November 4th, the next morning, any publication that had the Obamas on the front page, those sold out, instantly and are now collector's items on eBay. So we didn't know if we would have that same response in terms of us doing a book, but we knew that there were iconic images of the Obamas already out there. We wanted to make sure we included those images, like the September 2008 image of the Obama family on our cover, so we had to include that. We had to include the fist bump because there was so much controversy and misunderstandings about what that meant as a cultural cue that so many of our readers just understood instinctually. But what we were really looking for were those quiet, intimate moments between Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, and also the children, because this family has taken on, a sense of belief and feeling and inspiration and aspiration within our community, unlike anything I've ever seen. I remember growing up and seeing pictures of the King family, Martin Luther King and Coretta King and their children. It was something, they were like family friends, and the Obamas are that to the nth degree. So any place where we could humanize them, to show Michelle separately with Malia, separately with Sasha, to show them together, to show them during intimate moments, we definitely wanted to record, because those were images that we weren't seeing in the mainstream media.
No, that's true. One more quick question.
Sure.
You have a lot of images, beautiful images of Sasha and Malia. Is there a line, do you think, that with the kids, that where, photographers and news magazines would sort of try to be a little careful in terms of how they capture them? Or do you think they're sort of free for all on some level?
Well, I think that it really is about the journalistic institution. I mean, at Essence Magazine, these were all pictures that were captured on the campaign trail, with the Obamas' permission. We would never do anything that would, exploit the daughters. I mean, we vigilantly protect their growth and evolution because they didn't run for office. They didn't seek office.
Right.
And there's something about watching them evolve as well. These beautiful two African-American girls, with all this mirth and innocence and hope ahead of them that I think many of our readers want to see protected.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. And as he continues in office, though, what do you sort of foresee in terms of the coverage? I mean, he's in a great honeymoon period now, but in terms of sort of it going on and on, again, you think that fascination is going to stay?
He already has critics. The critics are going to get louder. Is he going to maintain that steady cool? Will the nation tire of that steady cool? Will Americans have patience? Will his poll numbers decrease? That's to be determined. That's almost to be expected.
Thank you, Patrick.
And thank you for having me.
That was NPR's Allison Samuels speaking with Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine and the editor of The Obamas, Portrait of America's New First Family. He joined us from our studios in New York.
Just to dance our way out of our constriction. Gonna be freaking up and down the hang-up alleyway with the groove I only got.
Loud speakers, but I'm speaking loud vernacular.
And now a bit of poetic commentary from the one and only funk master George Clinton. Today's topic, the war on drugs.
U.S. Custom Coast Guard dope dog, nicknamed Bustum. Like most dope sniffing dogs, he's got a habit, trained to have it. Pick up the tracks of the traffickers and track them like a rabbit up the coastline. Canine control substance retriever, receiver of the Golden Nose Award for leading them to the cash, cashing in on the stash. Now he's in line for his issue of the booty. Never do he do a line in the line of duty. He's a dope dog, a U.S. Custom Coast Guard dope dog. Keen sense of smell, tracking the telltale trails of cartel dope boats. Big dope, never a gram or OZ kilo too low key. Gotta be tons of Piblo, bales of Lumbo. While other dogs are sniffing one another's tail, he can track the profit from a dope sale straight to the stink account. Big banks, banking on laundered dirty money not stinking. As the wind blows, he get a whiff, he take a sniff, he just follow his nose. OMAC uncle had some drugs, C-I-A-I-O. And with those drugs, he bought some arms, C-I-A-I-O. There was a bang bang here and a snort snort there. Here bang, there snort, banging snorts everywhere. OMAC uncle starts a war, C-I-A-I-O.
Before we go any further, maybe we should explain. When musician George Clinton came to visit our show, we asked him to tell us what was on his mind. And, well, that's what came out. And it went on.
An undercover narc with a bark took a bite out of crime. Posing as a CNI dog, he bit the blind. The man with the cane made of coke. As sure as the dope boats float, the media goes comatose. Unrelated over-the-counter overdose now become drug-related. Aided and abetted by a lot of apprehension and indifference. The bigger the headache, the bigger the pill. Y'all can take your medicine now, because you're going to be ill when I tell you the deal on dope. There is more profit in pretending that we're stopping it than selling it. Roof.
George Clinton is in his late 60s now, and after more than 50 years at it, he and his P-Funk All-Stars are still party favorites with young and old alike. His latest CD is called George Clinton and His Gangsters of Love. It's a look back at some of the old school classics that inspired him most when he was just getting started. We wanted to talk with him about it and about the amazing Everything But the Kitchen Sink musical universe that he managed to get us all dancing in. So here's a trip into the mind of the P-Funk master himself, George Clinton.
Staying way too long and I can't do without you. Every chance you get, you seem to hurt me more and more.
Well, I've been waiting to do this for a long time because doo-wop was my first love. And all the songs of the 50s and 60s, you know, music is... need something different right about now. So I say, let me see if I can do some singing of love songs. And when I started doing that, I started thinking about love. In the 50s, the fellas didn't mind getting on one knee. They say, darling, I love you. You know what I'm saying? But today you got to keep your gangster on. You know what I'm saying? It's a whole other thing, and they're still in love. They're still in love. It don't sound like it, but they get married and they have children like everybody else do. I ain't trying to school them because it's done changed already. It's too late to school them. I got to learn. You know what I'm saying? Matter of fact, I was on the elevator, and I heard the guys on there, they was cursing, and the young girls was on there. I said, man, won't y'all be cool? The ladies on there. She said, uh-oh, here go Captain Save-A-Ho. I was like, uh-oh, let me get my gangster on and figure out how to talk like this. Oh, I'm a Smokey fan, you know, as far as the writer's concerned. And Marvin Gaye did the song, and it was always a song that I thought was one of the best written songs, the lyrics in that. And so I had to do that one. Started out about 14. We saw Frankie Lyman doing his thing and girls screaming. Oh, of course I'm going to have some of this. You know, and skip school to go to the Apollo and see the Spaniards, the Flamingos, and Jackie Wilson, Clyde McFadden in the 50s. I mean, we watched everybody. You know, right up to the 60s when Smokey and the Miracles and the Temptation blew in town. Motown came out. That was the new doo-wop. And I went straight to work for them and did that until we got our first hit record was in 66. I Want to Testify. by the time we got our hit record, doo-wop was over again. Because here come the English groups coming over here doing what we had done, what our, you know, mothers liked, the blues and the Shake It Up, Baby. We was on our way to the Copa in Las Vegas. We were trying to be, you know, ritzy, but then we met them guys coming over with jeans and torn up shirts. We was talking about hippie, but we knew how to be hippie. We knew how to be, you know, like raggedy. So we went back, got us some diapers, some sheets off the Holiday Inn bed, and we went crazy on them. Got our mind blown out, you know what I'm saying? Tripped on out of here, and we didn't come back. Temptations on Acid, we were gone. Because we had missed the beginning of this psychedelic era. We had to catch up. So we went totally nuts. Took the amps all the way up and went out. And pretty soon we was, okay, we made it like it was brand new. Slowly coast on back into, you know, the mothership connection. GC at the time, and there's so many Afros, as far as you could see, and then a bunch of hippies all in this concert we had. And you look out over the hill, somebody said, One Nation Under a Girl. She said, Wow, young, they come to see y'all, and they're like, One Nation Under a Girl. Title. We took that and went right to the studio and recorded that concept. We're dancing our way out of our constrictions. More of What You're Funking For. That's going to be our redeemer. Dancing our way around all the problems. Ain't nothing wrong. We'll be all right by Thursday.
You're listening to the riffings of funk master George Clinton. Clinton has had epic fights with record companies over the use of his music. He's been a major inspiration to hip-hop, and he just may be the most sampled musician of all time. But Clinton says he has rarely been paid proper royalties.
And it's not against the artist that did it. It's the record companies that took it out of the artist's royalties and didn't give it to us. I got some of them back. I got One Nation back, Knee Deep. Got those back. But there's a lot of other ones and a lot of other monies that are over $150 million worth. But we're not going to sweat and cry and over it. If somebody sample our record, making a record, we're going to sample theirs back.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy.
They was not going to let that record be it was selling all the time. It ain't never stopped selling. But that's when they decided that they weren't going to give us our money. They told us right then, it's not going gold. It's not going to be gold. It never went gold as far as they're concerned. They still tell us it never went gold. And we all know that. And some people have bought the record 100 times. They bought the plastic, the CD, now download it. You know what I'm saying? It's so many records sold, but they still claim that it never sold gold. Look on the wall of Tupac, 16 million records, and he sampled Atomic Dog. Same thing with somebody else. We all know better than that, but it's catching up to him.
You may compete.
That one give you excuse to go nuts. And that with the dog in you, instincts are set free. You're allowed to do all that animals do. You know, you put thinking on hold for a minute. And the tongues come out and they wagging and they everything they see is a tree. Just give you an excuse to go crazy.
Change the cat.
Flashlight will give you an excuse to jump up on the dance floor and then need to do the same thing. But Tommy Dog, you ain't got to know how to dance at all. You can just like
jump you behind on out on the floor and do the butterfly or the caterpillar, whichever you want to do. But you do the best you can, and, you know, and you're all right then.
My motto is
make my the people. I'm on my funk uncut. Yeah, make my funk the people. I want to get funked up.
George Clinton, his life and times in his own words. Clinton's latest CD is called George Clinton and His Gangsters of Love. One last thought from the funk master. We asked what he would want people to say about him years after he's gone. He says, seeing that he was literally born in an outhouse, his epitaph should read,
his mother thought it. She had to go to the bathroom when he was born. He was destined to be funky.
You can watch video of this interview on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.